Are you serious, Caitlin?
Oh my god. We have to wait for like a minute and a half while Caitlin decided to make popcorn in the kitchen.
Welcome to Coach Your Brains Out, the show that explores learning from the top minds in volleyball and beyond. With your hosts, John Mayer, Billy Allen, Andrew Fuller, and Nils Nielsen.
Today, we're lucky to have Walt Kerr. Walt is the owner and coaching director of Legacy Volleyball Club, located in Santa Clara, California. Walt, thanks for joining us today.
Happy to be here.
Yeah. So you've been in the business a long time, and you have a lot of accolades and a lot of history and much too much to list here, but there's definitely a couple of highlights that I wanted to touch upon before we got going. Number one, you were on staff for the UCLA men's team in 2006 when they won their last national championship. Right. And then number two, you actually started the Northridge men's volleyball team program back in 1976.
Correct.
If that is correct, Billy and I owe you a big thank you.
Yeah, you're very welcome. It was my pleasure. It got me a job.
That should be number one, Nils.
There you go. But I wanted to end with a Go Matadors before we started things off. So thank you for that, Walt. That's fantastic.
Billy, can we edit that out?
Not a chance.
So the topic today is coaching coaches, and I thought of you as a really good person for this topic, mainly because of the development program we've talked about at your club at Legacy. But my understanding is also that you've had touch base with a lot of coaches in the Division I right now. A couple would be Dave Rubio in Arizona, Jared Elliott in Texas, Mark Rosen from Michigan. I'm sure there's a few more, but those are the ones I know of off the top of my head. Before we dive into the development of newer coaches, can you tell us a little bit about what the heck you're teaching and mentoring those coaches?
Well, most of those guys that you just listed are their own man for sure now. They've been at it a long time also. They were all former students of mine. Mark and Dave both played for me. Believe it or not, Rubio played for me. At Granada Hills High School. I also started the boys program there in 1974 when I was a 19-year-old. And coached Dave first in high school for a couple of years and then at Cal State Northridge after that. Rose and I coached at Northridge. And then Jared was in a class called Theory of Coaching Volleyball that I taught at Cal State Northridge way back in the day also. So all three of those guys, I go back to at least their college years, if not longer. And, you know, occasionally I'll get a phone call from someone, but those guys are very experienced, stand on their own coaches at this point. Rubio, I've had the most interaction with through the years. There was several years when he was a newer coach in Division I at Arizona, and this is 15 to 25 years ago, because he's been there 25 years now, that I would fly out and do a coaching evaluation of their program. I'd stay for about 2 or 3 days. There's a lot of feedback about his assistant coaches and the roles they played and the kind of feedback they were giving, as well as drill design, areas of need, and, you know, good for Dave that he was willing to put his ego aside and have someone else come in from the outside, even though I'd been his mentor, to do a formal evaluation. And I type something up very formalized and send it off to him. So, but he's been one of my best friends since he graduated from college. So we have that kind of a relationship.
It's pretty amazing. He's a pretty big time coach out there. So I know if he's taking your feedback, we're lucky to dive into it with you today. So I kind of wanted to go in the direction of the clinics that you put on for your coaches there at Legacy, because I know that's kind of maybe the beginning of their greatness into coaching. So can you tell us a little bit about the clinics that you put on for your coaches?
Sure. There's two parts to what I would consider our formalized continuing education with our coaches. The first part you mentioned is coaching clinics, and we do about 15 of these throughout the year, and they range from topics that start with the basics of biomechanics for each one of the fundamentals. So we're breaking down the basic fundamental itself, and then also the proper error detection and error correction. And in the that we're in our 10th year now. In the early years, when all the coaches were kind of on the same plane, I was fortunate enough to have a lot of young coaches early on, but I was presumptive enough to say I'm going to be their mentor, and we're going to require that everybody come to these clinics. I know that a lot of clubs will do one or two a year. We ran 15 hour and a half sessions per year, roughly. And at those clinics, we'll break down basic biomechanics through all the six or seven fundamentals. And then we'll also do things like the tactical part of the game, what systems operate best, what are the advantages and disadvantages of each system. We'll talk about practice organization, shagging systems, how to get the players the most touches possible, how what time frames should be assigned to different fundamentals. We'll also talk about advantages and disadvantages of coach-injected or initiated drills versus player-initiated drills. And then we'll also do some mental habit training. And last but not least, we do some match coaching, which is really one of the fun clinics that I do every single year. And that we actually have a live scrimmage going on, and I'll assign two coaches, one to coach each of the teams on the side of the net. And when the first timeout is called, the six players will walk over to the sideline to listen to the coach. The coach will walk out to face them, and 25 other coaches will stand behind the six athletes and listen to the same feedback that those six athletes are getting. And so that coach is talking to 31 people at the same time in a timeout. When the timeout is concluded, we come over and we do a formal evaluation of that coach, talking about how was his eye? Did he identify the right things to talk about? Was the prioritization proper? And then how was his verbalization of that? Was he succinct? Was he specific? Did he muddy the waters, or did he stick to one very important topic that's the most important thing to have talked about? And then in some of the years, I've sent a spy, so to speak, out to the players after the timeout's over and ask them the question, what did you hear in the timeout? And then we come back and give the coach feedback there. And it's really awesome, because I believe that coaches are in the business of behavior modification. We're modifying our athletes' behavior. And here I am, and I can see it right in front of me changing. I'm modifying the behavior of the coaches, because they're getting to actually role play and practice speaking at a timeout in a pretty pressurized situation, because they have 25 of their peers listening to them as they speak. So that's one of the really fun clinics we do. But basically, it's those 15 hour and a half clinics that I run throughout a season, ranging on those different topics.
And Walt, do you find that people give you a lot of pushback when you're, you know, maybe being critical or giving them feedback? How do you handle that?
Yeah, certainly tact is one of the key elements there. And that's a great question. There's a couple things that I've experienced, and it's actually really rewarding. I've said this a million times. Before I started my own club 10 years ago, way back in the late 80s, I was asked to be the coaching director for Zuma Bay Volleyball Club, which was out in the Conejo Valley. And they had 12 teams practicing in the same gym every Monday and Wednesday night. And they brought me in on Monday nights, and I actually did a clinic every single week. And I'll give you a very specific example. Moore Canham, who was a former player at UCLA and was looking at this lowly Division II coach and going, what does this guy have to teach me? And she was really challenging of me in the first couple of weeks as I was breaking down fundamental stuff and we were doing biomechanical things. I felt a ton of, as you put it, pushback from her about why this, why that, why do you say this? And I was forced to justify the reasons why I believe that this was the best way to attack, this was the best way to set, whatever it happened to be. And I could tell by about week four, I started to win her over. And that was really rewarding for me, because she was a really bright gal, but she just wasn't really sold on the idea of some guy coming in and telling her how to coach. And the end of that story is the following year, I hired her to be my assistant coach at Cal State Northridge. She went on to be an assistant coach to Greg Giovinazzi at University of Michigan, and then became her own head coach at Wright State University for many years. So I won her over enough where she bought into the things I was saying. And for me, that process has been really rewarding. I named the name of my club Legacy Volleyball Club for three reasons. The first one is our logo is a pyramid and John Wooden was my idol. And I wanted to have the pyramid of success and an image of that be a reminder to all my athletes. And I talk about Wooden a lot and a lot of the Woodenism stem. The second one is we broke the pyramid into three pieces instead of 15, like Wooden's pyramid of success. And those are for my three sons because I always thought it'd be cool to have a father-son business. So the second part of legacy is my three sons who are all actively involved in the club. But the third reason and the reason I bring it up to you guys is that I think that a lot of clubs, and not all of them, the typical process is you hire people that have played volleyball in the past, whether it was high school, club, junior college, or university volleyball. And they may or may not have any coaching experience, and you hand them a whistle and six volleyballs and 12 players and a court time and say, have a nice day. And there really isn't much direction given to them. And I wanted to create a legacy of coaches that were professionally trained and that had been passed on all the information that I've garnered over the 44 years I've been involved in volleyball. And like I said, I love coaching players, but I love coaching coaches as much. I always really enjoyed doing seminars and clinics around the country when I was invited to do those, and I found them really rewarding. So do I get some pushback? Yeah. The key is to be able to put a little, as one of my coaches said, honey with the vinegar. You know, I'll tell them what they did right first. I'll compliment them on something that I found that was positive, but then we'll also in a tactical way, a tactful way, tell them how they could improve on what they did. And I usually try and give them the why, not just do it because I said so. And I think that most of the coaches have bought into it really well.
So you mentioned you, when you teach the skills, you go through the biomechanics. Can you go into that maybe for one of the skills, say something like passing, like how you break that down?
Sure. It's interesting. Marv Dunphy and I had a conversation 6 to 9 months ago. I can't remember when. And Marv and I would do that when we'd bump into each other when he was recruiting at boys tournaments and I was there as the director. And he said he went to a clinic and the guy was talking about passing. And they said, when you first correct a kid in serve receive passing, do you work on their footwork first or your arms first? Is it the platform or is it the footwork? And Marv asked me, and I said, I think I'm a platform guy. He goes, I am too, but there was a lot of guys that are footwork guys. We both agreed it doesn't matter which one you break down first, but that they both need to be taken care of. But it was an interesting question. Anyway, I think I'm a platform guy first. So I talk about the grip of the hands and making sure the thumbs are parallel and the fat pads are touching so that the forearms are parallel, making sure that there's no elbow flexion and that the elbows are connected as much as possible, the tight platform immediately, that we want as quiet a platform as possible so the arms start away from the body, approximately 90 degree relationship between platform and torso, which means you're bent over at the waist in order to create proper angle deflection. I want knees bent. I want, as they move to the ball, no bouncing. I want the head to stay horizontal all the time. If you ask any player that I train, what are the three most important things in passing? The answers are vision, vision, and vision. I think all the greatest passers in the world have great eyes. I think that my son Tony was such a successful libero because his visual skills were better than most people. And so the ability to track the ball is paramount. And having the head move horizontally and not bounce up and down means that your vision is enhanced rather than hurt. And so I want the head to be as quiet as possible to enhance the visual skill. When there are movement, when we're talking about serve receive on the girls' side, we have shuffle lunge steps to all balls, trying to be grounded at the point of contact. We want the platform to move as little as possible. And Karch's phrase, which is set the angle, freeze the angle. And I love stealing phrases like that from anybody that I think has good ones. And so the ball only knows one message. That's a common message I send my athletes. So where your hips are facing doesn't matter. It's what the platform tells the ball to do. So set the angle, freeze the angle. And we talk and ask two questions. One, did the ball hit you in the sweet spot? And it's question number one, because nothing else matters. If the ball doesn't find your sweet spot, you can't expect it to go where you want. Question number two is, was your sweet spot aimed at target, which is the set the angle, freeze the angle part of it. So there's a quick synopsis of the basic biomechanics of serve receive. Oh, by the way, on the men's side, we believe in not shuffling, but single leg lunges in any direction with the pace of the ball getting on the passer in a hurry. There isn't time to shuffle. And so all the movements made, with the exception of maybe a roll shot, are either a single lunge step right, forward lunge step, single lunge step left, or maybe a drop step backwards to prepare a sweet spot to be at the point of interception, because there just isn't enough time to do more than that. And the guys are long enough typically where a single lunge step, they can cover the whole court between the three-person serve receive.
I had a quick question about that. So you emphasized that the reason it's different for the men and the women is just because of the speed of the ball in the men's game?
Yep.
Okay.
Well, that's the primary reason. I'd say also guys can cover more ground. They're longer. You know, you get a 6'4 outside hitter that's passing, you're going to get, in women's game, especially at the club level, which is where I'm working now, the girls are 5'6 to 5'10, maybe 6 feet if they're a really tall pin. So they can't cover as much length, and the distance between them and the seams is a little bit greater. So a shuffle step would be more appropriate. But, you know, the guys are serving the ball 50 to 70 miles an hour. The girls are serving the ball 32 to 40 miles an hour. It's a pretty dramatic difference.
Nice. And let's just to step back and get a little more broad to start here. Are there any, I'm sure you deal with a lot of different personalities in your coaches. Are there any key traits that you look for or nurture when it comes to maybe a good coaching personality or temperament?
I love it. The first thing I do, and I say this at every interview when I'm hiring coaches, and the nice thing is now being 10 years into the club, I'm starting to hire a lot of former players, which is really cool because I know them as people and they already know our language. So the terms that we might use as cue phrases that would be new to you, even though you've been around volleyball for a long time, are going to be old hat for them. And so the part of the training process is accelerated. It's a different hat for sure, because they heard it as a player. Now they have to see it and say it as a coach. But I always have said I hire people first and then train them to be good coaches. And so for me, I care desperately about, at the end of the year, what does my athlete think about that coach? And I don't want to hire coaches that are insecure or egotistical or arrogant, because those people are people that are going to display characteristics and traits and behavior that are really counterproductive to what I believe is the right kind of coaching atmosphere I want to create in my club. There's an ego involved with any good coach, but there's a difference between ego and arrogance. And I think I'm a very self-confident person. And I think that there's a real opinion that I have, a super strong opinion about what's the best way to coach. And I want all my coaches to develop that kind of persona. But I want them to do that in a really positive fashion. And people that are insecure or arrogant or egotistical, they tend to want to, when the things aren't going well, they're the first one to point the finger at their own team instead of looking at themselves and saying, what can I do to help my athlete get better? What can I do to help my team get better? And there's so much evidence of that out there in the world of coaching where, you know, you see these horrible faces on the coach. They're so disgusted with their team because they want to distance themselves from the poor execution of their athletes. But, you know, how our athletes perform isn't a reflection of us. Now, how they act as people can be a reflection of us because we can hold them to standards of behavior. But people are human and some people are skilled more than others. So sometimes you lose because you don't bump, set, spike, serve, block, and dig as well as the other team does. In fact, most of the time, that's why you lose. So anyway, the bottom line is I hire people based on having positive human characteristic traits.
So that kind of leads into my next question. And is the idea of, like, can you tell if somebody's going to be a good coach immediately when they come to your club?
This is great. I just said this. I wanted to tell you this too. One of the challenges for me as a club director is I now have some coaches that have been coaching with me in their 10th season, and I have other ones that are in their first season. So how do you make that an interesting coaches clinic? And the answer is I've now 3 years ago split them, and half of my coaches clinics are for first and second year coaches only, and half of them are for all the coaches. And at the first year coaches only, which I tend to front load those clinics a little bit more, we do a lot of error detection and error correction. In the all coaches attending, there tends to be more complex things. We'll do the timeout efficiency one during that one, and we'll also do some sports psychology. Usually sometimes there's a bunch of things that I've observed from going to tournaments that I've made a whole checklist on, and I want to take it to all the coaches to talk about these things and say, hey, we can do a better job in all our practices at emphasizing this. We can do a better job in all of our practices at emphasizing that. And so it makes it interesting for both my veteran coaches and my younger coaches. But I want to tell you this too. I've been coaching for 44 years, and I've done a lot of clinics and seminars over the years. And it wasn't until a few years ago, even after I started at Legacy, and I started doing the mentoring program immediately. It was those coaches clinics were mandatory on Sunday nights, 15 times a year, hour and a half. And but I read a book that was about mentoring on John Wooden, and it was written by a bunch of people that felt like they'd been mentored by him, many of them former players, but not all of them. Some of them were coaches that had either gone to a summer camp and worked for him, or even people that had mentored by reading his books and been mentored from afar. And it really empowered me to look at myself more as a mentor. And even though I was already doing it informally, it kind of formalized it in my own brain, and it made me even more assertive and feel more responsible toward that responsibility of making my athletes or making my coaches better at what they do.
That's awesome. So I have a quick follow-up and then another question on the same topic. So you talked kind of about a checklist of things that you noticed that you can do better with your coaches. Can you give us like maybe one or two examples of things that you see that are very common that you feel like your coaches could do better?
Here's one of the ones that I hit them with last year, and obviously we're just getting started this year. But I think we'd been so thorough in the biomechanical side of things, and we've been so thorough in the practice organization side, that when I watched my typical coach, and this is a generalization, but when I watched my typical coach coaching in practice, I would see the first hour being really effective and efficient. I love the drill design. I love the feedback they were giving them. There was lots of great error detection and error correction going on in the biomechanics of bump set, spike serve, block dig. But they get to the second hour, and now they're doing more whole learning, six-on-six kind of drills. And my coaches tended to become more of ball injectors and occasional spectators for sure, and occasionally saying, hey, you're out of position here, you need to be standing here instead. And I think that's a real mistake. And I look at a lot of things, and I've said this for a long time too, I can watch a team play and go, wow, they're really well trained. And there's two parts to that. When I used to watch Long Beach State and Brian Gimolero's teams train, everybody passes the ball the same. Everybody has the same approach. He was super dogmatic about the biomechanics of the sport. And so from a fundamental standpoint, those teams were outstanding. But there's another part to that, and that's a systematic part to it. Are balls dropping? What happens when the setter touches the first ball? You know, it could be as simple as, oh, the libero is supposed to touch the second ball, but sometimes you see stuff that goes down on the weird plays. And I think that that's the kind of stuff that a lot of coaches don't reinforce, and they don't reinforce it specifically enough in a six-on-six environment. And you hear this kind of thing. A ball drops between three players. It was equal distance. They all started to move for it. They all thought the other person was going to get it, and the ball drops. And the typical feedback from a coach is to yell out to the court, you guys have to talk better. Ugh. To me, that's such a ridiculously generalized, nothing learned statement. Certainly there needs to be better communication, but what exactly was that communication? Whose ball should that have been? Why is it? And your training judgment. And I think that's something that people don't do nearly enough of. And so there needs to be that, hey, because this happened, the ball was right of center this far and it was flat. Therefore, the setter didn't have time to get to that ball left front, even though you're not a setter and you want to be making an approach and retracting, you needed to react to that ball. The next time you see that same ball, will you please react to that ball? That's a simple example of the kind of things that could be said in a 6-on-6 environment drill that are left out. And I find that I've developed a skill now where in the women's game, if there's a long rally where the ball goes back and forth over the net 6, 8, 10 times, I'm sitting there making mental footnotes because there's 4 or 5 people that I want to say something to when the rally's over. And so the rally ends and I might say, hey, Judy, on that play, you made a nice Zorro step to pass that dink, but you didn't make a very good pass out of it. You got to pop that ball up much higher. And Kelsey, you got to get off the net much faster. You had a limited approach and it was super abbreviated and there was time on that pass to get off further. And hey, Jill, you're lucky that so-and-so covered for you on that play because that was your spot to be covering. And I can parrot back 3 or 4 things that happen in a rally and hold all of them accountable, because what happens if you don't do that, you're just reinforcing the bad habits of them being out of position. And I'm going to give a shout out to Charlie Brand right now, because I remember watching Charlie, and I'm a coach watcher for sure. I always have been. And I watched Charlie's team when he was coaching for Orange County 1 year, and he had a rally that went on and on and on and on. And every girl was super intense and in the right spot. The left side hitter got set 3 times in a row. She got blocked 3 times in a row. They made a perfect cover, setter set a nice ball. She got blocked again, covered the ball, blah, blah, blah. At the end of the play, the girl hits a high flat ball off the top, which Charlie teaches like crazy. The girl gets a touch and a kill. And the second that the ball goes, I look at Charlie and his eyes are scanning to see if he can catch any one of the other 5 players out of position. And they're all perfect. And it didn't matter because Charlie was yelling at one of them saying, you got to get down lower on that play. You weren't ready for that. Get down lower. And they were all perfect through the whole rally. But I loved it because this expectation of not letting them relax and not letting them not have a job to do within that rally and holding them accountable to a perfect standard and maybe even a beyond perfect standard was something that I think a lot of coaches neglect when they get into the 6-on-6 environment and they just let the players play and figure it out on their own. And I think that's a deceleration of learning instead of an acceleration of learning.
That's awesome. That's a lot of information. There's a lot of different directions we could go with that. I have a ton of questions, but I do kind of want to actually go back even because that explanation is awesome and it's also very overwhelming. So I kind of want to go back and think about like what is the in those clinics, those first and second year coaches, like if I'm a coach and I'm the first time I'm there, what's some of the first things that I'm going to learn in that situation?
Yeah, I have complete and thorough outlines of each one of the 6 fundamentals, and we hand those out as we break down underhand passing, setting, attacking, defense, serving, blocking, and then I will bring athletes in as demonstrators and I bring them in at different age levels. So we'll have a 12 and under girl and a 14 and under girl and a 15 and under girl that might be advanced and another one that's beginning and an 18 and under girl. And we'll bring in a boy that's younger and a boy that's older, and we will error detect and error correct on them. And what I usually do, especially in the first couple, is I will let the coaches watch several reps, even though I might have error detected on them in the first rep or second rep. I'll let them watch 8 to 10 reps of the kid doing it. And I'll say, okay, formulate in your head what you would have said to the athlete when they're done. And then I will then error detect and error correct. So they'll watch me and I'm role modeling for them and training their eye. I also teach a ton of private lessons every week. And I invite all of my coaches to come anytime and observe them. And some of my best instructors have been the ones that have taken me up on that offer, because in fact, one of my top coaches who's now coaching at the collegiate level, Brandon Pank, who's a volunteer assistant at Cal State Fullerton. He, I would say in the first year, he came and observed 150 hours of private volleyball lessons and didn't get paid a penny for that. All he did was he wanted to come watch. And his comment was, the first several weeks that I came and watched you, I tried to imagine what I would say before you said it on each rep, and I was matching you about 50% of the time. He goes, now a year later, I feel like I'm matching you about 95% of the time. And I could see that in his coaching when he was coaching a team, and I'd listen to him and I'd watch one of his athletes do a rep, and then I'd listen to his feedback, and it was almost exactly the words I would have said, both in the error detection phase and in the phraseology and the error correction phase of it. So anyway, to answer your question specifically, the first couple weeks I will be the demonstrator and I'll be the role model, but we evolve into that the coaches being put on what we call the hot seat, where they're the ones that are actually speaking in front of the other coaches. And it's again, a positive environment. I'm not ripping people. I'm saying, hey, you did a great job with this, but you really missed out on this part of it. You needed to see this part of it and watch this girl now. You see how her elbows are too far apart. She's got to squeeze her platform better. Look at how her elbows are getting too close to her belly button. She's got too much swing in her arms, whatever the correction happens to be. So that's what happens in the first few clinics. This is very fundamental based on bump, set, spike, serve, block, dig. And especially in the women's game, it's more fundamentally based on underhand passing, serving, attacking, and setting. We don't spend a lot of time on blocking because it's the least important. I always said in the women's game, blocking is the 15th priority on a 7-priority list. So the bottom line is that it's very fundamentally based the first many sessions. And by the way, I didn't mention this. I said there was a 2-part to the formalized education and program we do. The first part is these coaches' clinics. The second part is I go and do formalized evaluations on all my coaches. And my newer coaches, I do those on very early in the season. And I show up and watch the entire 2-hour practice. And I'm writing down every drill that they do. I write down the timeline of when they start the drill, when they finish the drill. If they are talking quietly to an athlete, I'll get up out of the chair that I'm watching them in, and I'll stand next to them and listen to the feedback they're giving so that I can hear it exactly. And I take notes on what was said, whether it was really awesome feedback and very accurate feedback. And then after the practice is over, I go through the entire practice with them. It takes about an hour to give them the formalized evaluation, and I'll go step by step through the 2-hour practice. And then on top of that, on the other side of the sheet, I have a coach's evaluation form, and it's an 18-point checklist that's broken down into 3 generalized categories. The categories are interpersonal skills. The second one is practice design and management. And the third one is teaching skills. And within those, there are 6 areas, and I grade them on a 12-point scale. And my master's degree statistics teacher in physical education taught me that instead of a 4.0 scale, 12.0 scale is more accurate because a 12 is an A, 11 is an A minus, a 10 is a B plus, a 9 is a B, and so on. And it gives you more specific feedback as to how you did. And in the early years when I was doing this with all the coaches, because they were all new, I was getting out to see them 2 or 3 times. And it was pretty cool because the first time I'd evaluate them, if they were getting a total score of, well, what's 18 times 12? Are they 226? Anyway.
I'm a volleyball coach, not a math guy.
Yeah, I think it's 226. You know, they might have scored 180 points, but the next time I evaluated them, they got 200 points. And the time after that, they were getting 210 points. And so you could see the improvement. And I could see the pride in the coaches as they were getting a better number grade on their tests. And granted, a lot of them were really nervous about that the first time I saw them. But the feedback that I got afterwards, I think A, because I made it positive, B, because I made it really specific, and C, because it made sense to them and they could look at themselves honestly and say, yeah, I can get better in this area. my progressions and my practice didn't make sense. I put this whole learning drill first and then did a part learning drill that should have come before that. It didn't make any sense to break it that way. I have to break it down the other way. And they're like, yikes. Okay. And the next practice, I'm looking at their practice and it's phenomenal because they're doing all the more progressive stuff first, working into the whole learning stuff later. So the coaches actually were requesting more of the evaluations as the years went along because they felt like it was so productive for them. And some of my veteran coaches are like, hey, you haven't evaluated me in a couple of years. Will you come out and do it again? Which is pretty awesome for a guy who's been doing it for 6, 7, 8, 9 years to want to be evaluated again. Normally it's like, ew, that's a scary thing. But I think most of them really have embraced the process.
That was part one of our interview with Walt Kerr. Join us next week as we continue our conversation on coaching coaches. Hey, this is part two of our conversation with Walt Kerr on coaching coaches.
Welcome to Coach Your Brains Out, the show that explores learning from the top minds in volleyball and beyond. With your hosts, John Mayer, Billy Allen, Andrew Fuller, and Nils Nielsen.
Staying with practices for a minute, what are some of the elements you teach to help your coaches create great practices?
Drill design is critical. It makes me nuts. And, you know, I used to, when I was coaching at Northridge, and I'd go out recruiting, whether it was to a boys' practice or a girls' practice, to watch an athlete play. And, you know, I'd see the kid touch the ball four times in the first 30 minutes of practice, and I wanted to, you know, slit my wrist. It was like, come on, can we get them touching the ball a little bit more frequently? So we talk about drill design and how important it is to find the athletes getting away to touch the ball more, and that player initiated drills are critical for that versus having one coach, or even if you have two coaches, it's still only one out of every six reps if you've got 12 players on a squad. So if you break it down and let the players initiate, you can do a drill like triples pass where there's at least four of the 12 girls touching the ball at one time. They're getting 50%, 100%, 200% more reps by just breaking that down. So drill design and the number of touches is one. Practice progressions, drill progressions, making sure that part learning comes before whole learning, making sure that the level of part learning is appropriate. And it's interesting having John on the phone. He comes from Pepperdine's background, and Marv's a whole learning guy. You guys did almost all three contact drills, right?
Oh yeah, big time.
Yes. So, and that's the philosophy of gold medal squared. And I learned in my motor learning classes back in college, in both my bachelor's and my master's, that all the studies show that the more advanced the athlete is, the more appropriate whole learning is. So if you're coaching at Pepperdine, it certainly makes sense to do whole learning stuff. But if you're coaching high school volleyball, club volleyball, kids that are less skilled and less experienced, that part learning is a much more effective way to get people to develop the skills in a more rapid fashion. And certainly you need to expose them to the whole learning stuff too, but having a combination of that within practice is key. And then having that progression be proper where it's part learning to whole learning makes the most sense. The kids have the opportunity to hopefully carry some of what they've done in the part learning environment over to the whole learning. We talk about pace of practice and finding shagging systems that make sure the athletes are touching the ball as much as possible. I'm a really pace-oriented practice. I've never seen one of Duke's basketball practices. I never got to see one of UCLA's basketball practices when Wooden was there. But I know growing up as a basketball player in the late 60s and early 70s, when Wooden was winning 10 out of 12 national championships in a 12-year period, that people always talked about sometimes his practices only lasted an hour and a half, but what they packed into that hour and a half was so efficient, moving from one drill to the next, to the next, to the next. So shagging systems and pace and having the water breaks be just a hybrid. It's not time to hang around the water cooler and tell stories, but to hydrate and get back on the court. And so our water breaks are 30 to 60 seconds at the most, and we're back into the next drill. We've got names for every drill so that the players can move to them quickly, and I don't have to go through a long explanation of what the drill is. We talk about in our practice organization about time emphasis. People talk about serving and passing and how important those two fundamentals are. And my boys have joked with me that on my tombstone, they're going to write the words that I've said the most in my lifetime, and serving and passing are going to go on my tombstone because they've heard that from me so much. But and yet, when you watch people's practices, they don't always give that time emphasis to those two fundamentals. So are you really willing to do that? And the problem is, it's not near as exciting. It's not as charismatic to run serving and passing drills. And yet, so what happens is coaches get bored with it and they want to move on to something that's more exciting, or they feel like the energy in practice is lacking. So now all of a sudden they're going to do a digging drill or a attacking because the energy immediately comes up when people are allowed to spike, or they're going to do a 6-on-6 drill that has an instant inject to it. And that continuous rally format is an automatic, but it's an automatic form of energy, but it's also a placebo because you don't get to get that when you get into a game situation. So attributing enough time to serving and passing is critical, and you have to be willing to put that time in. And I don't care if it's at the international level or at the elementary school level, I still think those two fundamentals are the most important fundamentals for sure. So those are some of the things that we think about. And then we also make sure we have competitive drills. I think it's really important to put numbers on drills. I think that Beal and Neville were brilliant back in the early 80s when they came up with that idea. There was no such thing as a wash drill that I know of before that. I'd been in volleyball for at least 10 years before they came around, but I'd never heard of a wash drill until the early 80s. And so that's another emphasis that we have, is the ability for the kids to compete and practice competing within the practice.
And when it comes to part versus whole drills, for the lower level or younger kids, are the players needing to reach a certain standard of mastery of the skill before you move on to the whole skill drills? Or is it just kind of every practice you'll do games no matter what based on time?
Yeah, I think there always has to be some whole learning in there. And even if the kids fail miserably at it, you need to expose them to it because they're going to get better at it. You know, and there's so many different levels of volleyball that we can talk about right here. You know, the female athlete at the 12 and under age group, the male athlete at the 18 under age group, they're two completely different animals. And so, but regardless, the throwing them into the deep end of the pool needs to happen to some degree for them to figure it out too, and to expose them to it. In my private lessons that I teach, I've got kids that have no business jump setting at all, but I'm training them as a setter, and they're still very fundamentally unsound in their staying on the ground traditional setting technique, but I'll still have them jump set several balls within a practice to expose them to that, so that a year from now, instead of them being exposed to it for the first time, they've had it a year earlier, and we've gradually progressed through the total failure to 98% failure to 95% failure and so on. So if you run any practice and there isn't some whole learning in there, you've really goofed. I think that there's always that struggle at the beginning of a season, especially in club in the way that it's designed now, where it's a race to get your team ready. And if you've got a 12s, 13s, 14s team and kids that have never played volleyball before, which happens a lot in our neck of the woods anyway, maybe not in the beach cities, they don't know what left front means. So they don't know the difference between a 6-2 and a 5-1. You got to teach them where to stand and how to not overlap. And if you go to any club tournament at the lower levels, there are kids that are running around with like chickens with their heads cut off because they don't know. So you got to spend some time in the whole learning environment just to teach them the systems of the game and where the heck to stand. But I think even at the higher levels, I'm about to coach my 16 and under team this year at Legacy. And our first practice is this coming Saturday. And my first hour is very fundamentally based on high level of repetitions in touches on the ball, in all the fundamentals. And then the second hour is very 6-on-6 oriented with a lot of whole learning, a lot of three touch type drills. But there'll be a ton of feedback that's given in that second hour as well.
And do you ever get to a point with maybe a higher level team near the end of the season where you're doing 100% game, like, you know, whole learning, or is there always some part practice?
Yeah. Here's an interesting drill that I've developed, and I call it serve receive flow through. And here's a frustration I have. Practicing serve receive and being a great side out team, nobody's going to argue that that's critical, right? And so the problem with it is, in the women's game, you serve a ball, there's a pass, a set, a spike, and then there's a rally that ensues for quite some time, a lot of times, and then someone jogs back to get ready to serve again. There's another serve, rally ensues for a long time, then there's a miss serve, and the number of touches that they're getting is really small. So serve receive flow through is a drill I designed where you're in a typical serve receive pattern, three passers, three hitter offense, but the setter's already standing at the net and there's no transition on the other side of the net. I've got servers serving on the other side of the net. They serve a certain number of balls pre-designated, and then they come over and they sub in for whatever position they play. So if I have two setters in my program, one serving, she might serve four balls. And then when she served her fourth ball, she comes and replaces the other setter. I got three middles in my program. Two of them are alternating, running ones and approaches. And there's the third one serves four balls. Then she comes over, kicks one of them out. She goes to serve. They come in. But the notion is that the serves come rapid fire. The minute that the ball is attacked by left, middle, or right front, there is another serve coming. And the reason there is because I have people waiting off the court that flow in and then flow through and back around to wait off on the end of the court, so that there's three sets of passing eyes waiting to receive service the minute the ball's hit. And so if left front goes to attack and she was passing in area five, there's a new person standing in area five by the time she's attacked the ball, because she was waiting off behind area five to step on. So we're getting a huge number of pass, set, attack in a serve receive format. And if you want, you can put blockers up against it, but we don't play the ball out. We just serve the next ball immediately. And I also tell my servers in that drill, you need to make minimum of 90% of your serves. If you miss a serve, you got to serve the next nine balls in a row in bounds, because otherwise serve receive flow through becomes serve receive drag drill, and we don't want that slow tempo. And so there's a drill that I do all the way through the season, but I might do more of that near the end of the year, and we certainly evolve to more 6-on-6, but I still want some touches like straight serving. You know, it's a single touch drill. There's no three contacts to that. And I want my players to serve what we call serve buckets. So they're serving a whole bucket of balls on the other side, serving back at them. We alternate serving back and forth, six players on each side. They get a high number of reps there, and I want them to get a high number of reps. At the end of the year, right before we go to playoffs, I want them to feel really polished and confident that they can serve the ball where they want to. And we've developed that skill over the course of the year. And I will tell you that I think that of all the things you could say about a coach, the single most important thing is skill development. And I think it's something that other coaches pride themselves on, getting their athletes to compete great, or getting them to work hard, or being intense, or different things like that. If you ask me, what's the thing that I do best? It's skill development. I help my athletes to become more skilled. And, we do that through high number of touches, really accurate feedback, consistent feedback, positive reinforcement, and specific correction advice. Anyway, to answer your question in a short way, we evolve to more whole learning at the end of the year. And as the year goes along, more whole learning, but there's still some individual touches to get them more repetitions.
Walt, can you talk a little bit about how you teach your coaches to inject balls into drills and how to do that correctly?
Awesome. That's such a good question and demonstrates some insight on your part that you've seen some bad injecting. So there's a couple things. One is if you're chipping balls over the net, and this is pretty cool that you asked that, because I've had three newer coaching clinics already. And by the way, Nils was invited to those, you guys, and he said he really wanted to come, and he hasn't made any of them so far.
That's true.
It's been brutal. You can edit that out if you want, Nils.
No, it's typical.
Anyway, but one of the girls, after like she'd been practicing with her 14 and under team, and at the end of the clinic, I said, hey, let's do a little bit of problem solving. Let's talk in the clinic about how your first couple weeks of practice have gone. And most of them are assistant coaches because they're newer. How has it been working with your head coach? Have you been able to grab the reins at all? Are you feeling comfortable speaking to the athletes? Have you been mentoring under your head coach? And one of the girls says, you know what? I'm really struggling with chipping balls over the net. Can you tell me exactly what the technique is for chipping? And so I literally was doing a demonstration of chipping, talking about how I don't toss the ball. I hit it right out of my hand. I make a fist and I punch it underhand like this, and my hand stays really quiet. And I showed them what part of my hand makes contact with the ball so that that athlete could figure out, because there's a lot of ugly chippers out there. I also will talk about the skill of tossing a ball underhand to set, because some people are terrible at it. And the other one that's really amazing is tossing ones, if you want the athletes making approaches and hitting ones, which we use as a progression. And the coaches are awful at tossing the ball with the right pace so that's not too high or not too low, and they have to continue to work on that. So we definitely talk about the technique of injecting balls in the simple environment of either chipping over that tossing, but also I will, with my own assistant coaches, I will give them feedback about how I want the ball injected. And sometimes they'll say, hey, the pace of your injection's too slow. You're giving side B too much time to recover. Let's pick up the pace a little bit. And I try and say that in a really respectful way and not with a frustration or an impatience to my assistant coach in front of the athletes. But there's a lot of people that don't really get it. They don't understand how I want the pace of that to go. And so there's specific feedback I give about that or the degree of difficulty. How hard do I want it? I remember in 1982, I went to a clinic in Cota de Casa, Mishivieho area, with Ari Selinger, who was our Olympic coach back in the early 80s and got the silver medal in 84 with our women's team. And he was talking about the fact that when they do a defensive drill, that every time there's a failure, they want to have a success. And that if they have two failures in a row, they need to make sure that the third ball is one that's successful. And so they were hitting really challenging balls at the girls that were having to dive and roll and sprawl to get to. But if they hit one that the girl wasn't successful in popping the ball up well, that they made sure the next ball was hit right at the belly button and making it an easy dig for her, so she was getting some success. And so understanding that kind of injection, I think, is really important too, because you can be either too easy in terms of degree of difficulty or too challenging. And so I try and coach the coaches on that kind of awareness also.
That's great, great stuff. We kind of want to switch gears and go more into some of the things that we do as coaches in the games and how you teach that. So let's start off with what's a coach's job during a game?
When I do my effective timeout coaching seminar, I hand out an article that I wrote for Coaching Volleyball 29 years ago, I think it was 88. Don't hold me to that, but years and years ago. And I still love it. It all the stuff that's in there, I still aspire to, I still believe in. And so there are two circumstances. One is when I called the timeout. The other one is when the other guy called the timeout. And are we playing well? And the other team called the timeout. And in that situation, I need to not kill the buzz, because the players are going to come in all excited and happy and joyful. But I need to reinforce what it is that we're doing well so that they continue to do that. Are we doing a great job at taking away number 7's line and channeling her to hit a cross court ball so that we're transitioning that ball. And if we are, keep doing it. If we're doing a good job of serving number four and she's been the shank master for them, we got to make sure we keep the ball on her. And if the libero starts cheating over to steal her ball, then we got to zip a ball down the sideline against her. So that kind of stuff, there's always tactical feedback from me, but the tactical changes depending on whether or not we're calling the timeout or not. If we called the timeout and things are not going well, the worst thing that can happen, and I'll give you an example, and this was a veteran coach, and the name will remain nameless, and the team that he was coaching, and I happened to be in on that timeout. I was sitting on their bench, and so I got up and I listened to the timeout, and they were beating a team that was ranked way ahead of them, one of the top teams in the country nationally, and our legacy team was beating them. It was like 20-15 or something. And the other team scored like 3 or 4 points, and that was 20-19. And he calls a timeout, which makes sense, right? The other team's got momentum. They're creeping back on us. And the players are – what they need at that point is some reassurance and a solution. And what was done instead was the coach screaming at him going, here you are blanking it up again. You do this every single time. And he's ripping them for giving up 4 points. And it's like, that's the worst thing you can do. You're pouring fuel on a fire that's already burning, and it's burning at the bottom of their feet. And now it's creeping up under their whole body because you just poured gasoline on that fire. What you need to do instead is say, look, here's what we're going to do to fix the problem. And having a calm voice, and I always have said that I think coaches in timeouts and in a match need to be like an actor, and there's a role playing that you do. The more energized your team is, the more relaxed you become, the more nervous your team is, the more relaxed your team become, the flatter your team is, the more energy you need to plug into them. And I think that's a responsibility of a coach to be able to do that. So here it is, and we're winning 20-15, and now it's 20-19. This guy's ripping him a new one for giving up a big lead. And then they go back on the court. There was no solution. Instead of, hey, the girl who's been serving us and get us out of system is serving a driven serve that's climbing up on you guys and jamming you. So let's take a step back, see the pace of the ball, make sure you're staying back on it so you can press the ball up the net. And then setter, when you get a good pass, let's make sure that we're running a 3-red combo. Middle hitter's front in the 3, so let's set the red and misdirect her. You're going to get one-on-one and terminate. And if you don't, in transition, they love to set number 12, so let's block her line and seam, direct her cross court. We're going to side out here, and then we're going to score points by serving number 7 as a reminder. Bam, I've given them a solution. This is what was broken. This is how you fix it. Go back on the court, do this, and you're going to be fine. And it's so the opposite that I hear so much in timeouts. And what normally happens is people talk about the last thing that happened. And it so might not be the most important thing that happens at a timeout, but a ball drops between two people. So instead of the fact that number 7's been killing us hitting line and we need to take it away on her and she's gotten 7 points out of the last 15 down the line, we come into that timeout and say, you guys have got to communicate when that's a weird out of system ball, which isn't talking to anyone, instead of saying, hey, Julie, you should have been talking to Susie on that play and saying, that's my ball because it was so flat. I'm going to call you off and step in to play that ball and reinforce that, but then move on to the more important issue, which is how are we going to score points and side out on the next point.
And what do you want your assistants doing during these timeouts? What's their role?
Great question. Two things. One is I like my assistant to be my and in the club volleyball environment, obviously we're limited. You know, I look at the staffs on college ranks and they've got 75 people on the bench. You know, there's the data volley guy and there's the all the assistant coaches and the volunteer assistant, the undergraduate volunteer assistant. And I think the trainer and the manager and the strength coach all have something they're charting too. So, but I've got one assistant. Typically, most of us have one assistant. I like them charting. I always have them stand on the inside of me on whichever side of the net I'm on. I'm a standing coach when I coach. Some coaches like to sit. I want to stand. I'm going to be near the sideline and talking to my athletes. And I want him, if I'm on the left side of the court, he's going to be on my right. If I'm on the right side of the court, he's going to be on my left. so that I can look through the net, but also look down at the chart at the same time. I asked my assistant coach to speak up to me before we serve all the time. Anytime we side out and we're going back to serve, to give me what he believes is going to happen the next play. Hey, they're going to set 7 and X2 on this play for sure. They're going to run 3 red. They've set the red 9 out of 10 times here. Let's double commit to the back set. So I have them talking to me that way. And then it's their responsibility to always have their finger on whichever rotation they're in. So if we've scored 3 points in a row and they call a timeout, I want him to have his finger on whichever row they're on so that I can look down and immediately do that. And then he hands me the chart and I'll hold the chart in front of the girls and talk to that while they have that visual reference. There are the other thing. So he's not normally talking in a timeout, but there are times that I might want to pull the setter aside to talk to her individually. And in that case, he'll talk to the 5 other athletes about scoring opportunities, who we're going to serve, how we're going to block in that next rotation, where a defensive player should shift to. Or it could be the reverse. And I normally try and prep my assistant ahead of time. Hey, I want you to go talk to the setter. I'm going to take the other 5 players. I want you to tell her that the middle blocker is still fronting the 3 and the 3 red combo. So keep going back to that well until it runs dry. And so there is sometimes that we split responsibilities on the timeout. Otherwise, I'm a big believer in having the head coach be the primary communicator, and having my assistants consult with me is great. In the college game, they have enough time to do that. In the club scenario, it's 30 seconds. Then the down ref's usually blowing his whistle after about 20 seconds. So you have to be really efficient in terms of that timeout talk. I arrange my athletes in a specific order in the timeouts. They know when they come to me, I want my right sides on the right. I want my middle and my libero in the center, and I want my outside left side hitters on the left side as they're looking at me. So their lefts are on my right, setter and oppo are on my left. And that way I can turn to both area 4 blockers and talk about what I want them to do. And I don't have to find one on the right side of the timeout and the other one on the left side of the timeout. The other girls that come from behind me to stand on the edge of the court, because the timeout out has to occur on the court in club volleyball. Those athletes stand just off the court. But again, I'll have my left side stand by their left sides, my oppos, and right side stand by my right sides on my middle blockers in the center right next to me, so that if I'm giving that direction, I know exactly where the athletes are and I have to go looking for them at a timeout, because we do a lot of very specific feedback to individual athletes about individual opponents. And that means you've got to be able to direct area 4 blocker versus area 2 blockers, depending on who you're talking about on the other side of the net.
Walt, do you have some sort of like a game day checklist for your coaches to follow as they learn this process that you have?
I have a scouting report form that I give to them that they can choose to use or not. You know, depending on the level of the team, again, you know, does our 13-2s team need to scout their opponent? No, they need to serve the ball over the net and not get aced. And if they could do those two things, we're going to win a lot of matches. But for the upper level teams, there's a checklist of individual tendencies that we're looking for. What kind of defense does their team run? Therefore, we know where to tip. Who's the serving targets on that team? Who's most likely to get set? How often does the setter like to dump? Where does she dump the ball to? Where do the hitters love to hit the ball to? Which is part of the charting, of course. But it's all the basic tendencies, strengths, and weaknesses of an opponent. They're listed in a formalized form that the coaches can use to do their scouting reports.
It's good stuff. So I prepped you a little bit on this, but for our last question, this comes from John Kessel. If you had to give your coaching philosophy in 3 words, what would it be?
Well, my children, as I told you earlier, would say serving and passing. But my philosophy, which I've referred to already too, but I'll sum it up at these 3 words: make them skilled.
I like it.
Good one.
I like it.
be better at bump set, spike serve, block dig. You're going to win a lot of matches. Tony and I were just talking about this earlier, and he was talking about, well, yeah, Dad, that's true at the club level. And he was looking at scouting opponents for the upcoming NCAA playoffs, saying there's a team that's very, very skilled, but they're not that big. And so they're going to come up against a bigger, stronger team, and they're probably going to lose because they don't have the athleticism. And I said, well, sure, that obviously is a component. But the bigger thing is when I watch Penn State play Texas in the finals of the national championship, the athletes are fairly equal in that case. And when they are, the one that bumps that spike serves, blocks, and digs better is going to win the match. And I've watched that with a critical eye for 44 years now, and I feel just as convicted today as I did 40 years ago, making my athletes more fundamentally sound. And if that's the last question, I'm going to leave you with this. John,
well, I do have one more question here, but this is more of a personal question. So you have three sons, all of which are coaches.
Yes.
I want to know who got the highest evaluation on their checklist.
There's no way I'm answering that question. What is this, Sophie's Choice? Are you kidding me? I'm not answering that. They all do a really good job. How's that for political correctness?
Yeah. All right. Well, let's hear the Wooden.
Yes. Wooden was asked once, who are the best coaches that he ever coached against? And you have to understand that Wooden is a really modest man, never bragged about himself. And then also, he's very politically correct. And his answer was, the best coaches I ever coached against were the ones with the best players. Now, my interpretation of that is, and the modesty that comes with that is, well, Wooden always had the best players, which is why he won national championship. And it wasn't just because he recruited Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Bill Walton, but it was because he took his players, and the best players, by the way, are the ones with the best skills. And certainly, you know, you can't take a jockey in the Kentucky Derby and turn him into a great middle blocker, and you can't take a sumo wrestler and turn him into a great jockey. But given that the parameters of the physicality is similar, then skill level is it. John Mayer ended up being a pretty freaking good right side hitter and helped Pepperdine win a national championship. And how tall are you?
Talk about a jockey.
I look like a jockey next to our team. I'm 6'1".
6'1". And he won the national championship in 2005 playing Oppo and tore UCLA up with guys that were significantly bigger than him. What'd you hit in the finals? Do you know?
Oh, I don't know. We just set Rooney every time.
No, you got set a lot of that match, and you had to hit over 400. And that was a skill set that you possessed to be able to pick and execute the right attack lines to be able to help your team win a national championship. Certainly Rooney was a big part of that, especially stuffing Alan Vince three times, I think, in a row at the beginning of game five. Not that I remember that and I'm bitter about it.
Yeah, you remember it better than me.
Was your was your scouting report to have nobody up on John?
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, so Wooden said the coaches with the best players, but it's really the players with the best skills. And Wooden was too modest to say, we win because I train my players to have better fundamental skills than other people. He was a fundamentalist, and they talk about the fact that his last practice of the year looked very similar to his first practice of the year because they were continuing to reinforce the great fundamentals of bounce passes and shooting bank shots from the wing and shortening the pass when you were the receiver of a pass, all kinds of basic fundamental, how to set a proper screen, how to prepare for the screen to be presented to your defensive player, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm a huge believer in that. And any success that I've had is first and foremost because I've developed the fundamental skills within my players. So make them skilled.
I love it. Walt, thank you so much for the time and the information and letting us pick your brain. I know my practices and my coaches will now be better for it.
All right. My pleasure, you guys. Always like talking volley, so anytime.
Great. Thanks, Walt.
It was fun.
Thanks, Walt.
Take care, guys. See ya.
Thanks for listening to Coach Your Brains Out. If you enjoyed the show, please leave us a review and subscribe on iTunes. You can follow us at Twitter @CoachYourBrain or Facebook.com/CoachYourBrainsOut. See you next week.